Good morning. This is Greg Roman on WWDB 860 AM Middle East Forum Century Radio, broadcasting live again from Israel, a different part of the country, though, today, up on the Syrian-Israeli border, reporting live from the now American-recognized Golan Heights, an area of land which traditionally had always been part of the biblical Kingdom of Israel, changing hands between dozens of different empires and states and mandates, and then again falling in itself with Israeli possession after the Six-Day War in 1967, June of 1967, now celebrating 52 years of the territory being in Israeli hands, having been annexed by the Prime Minister of Israel in 1981, and finally recognized by President Donald Trump in a declaration that took place only a few months ago. And it's an opportune time to discuss some of the issues which are meeting here head-on in the Golan Heights, where we find Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Turkey to a certain extent, of course, the two 800-pound gorillas in a room, the United States and Russia, all competing for influence and power all around the area, which is a small strip of land, but basically where many of the world's political, military, and sectarian interests meet. Gary, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing all right. I mean, it's been really an eventful week here. The Israeli week runs Sunday to Thursday, and I've had the opportunity to do a strategic tour up here in the north. I've had the opportunity to actually get down to the south. We did a tour of Gaza on Sunday. This is sort of the, get out and try to do some in-the-field Middle East analysis this week over here, and I'm actually heading to another country tomorrow. But I was hoping that you might be able to give us a little bit of feedback on what's going on with these reported secret negotiations between the United States and Iran being held in Iraq. Can you tell us anything about that? And if you can't, then maybe at least give us a little bit of background or a little bit of analysis of why the U.S. might be seeking these talks.
I think that's a good question. It's of course, President Trump has indicated numerous times that he's open to negotiating with the Iranians. Apparently, he was serious about that.
Now, we also have reports that yesterday, the Emir of Qatar, who was welcomed with a delegation on Monday night at the U.S. Treasury Department in the aptly named Cash Room, being held by his Secretary of Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, where we saw that there may have been a promise or a commitment from the Qataris to double the amount of trade that they do with the United States, going from somewhere in the $150 billion index to $300 billion. We saw contracts for planes signed with Boeing. We saw an $8 billion natural gas development contract with Chevron. Other individuals dealing with agriculture, with exports, imports, the provision of weaponry. And then we have this White House meeting taking place yesterday where I guess the economic interests were discussed on Monday night, and then Trump welcomes the Emir into the White House, into the Oval Office. The media is all around, and they continue to talk about political ambitions. For instance, the topic allegedly came up, according to a report in Politico, that the Qataris may be serving as a second outlet for indirect American-Iranian talks beyond what was reported in the Iraq instance. Do you think this is a signal that the White House is turning towards diplomacy, or are they two-tracking it, where they're doing, one, building the coalition against Iranian interests, and two, having the softer approach with the diplomatic outreach?
I think the administration is definitely contemplating diplomatic outreach. I think the escalation of tensions last month sort of gave everyone pause to consider whether we want a larger conflict with Iran. I would question whether the Qataris have anything to offer in that regard. It's not like they have a long and close relationship with Iran. It's something that's born out of strategic interests, out of their foreign policy and position in the region. So I don't think we need them as an intermediary.
No, I think they're trying to find relevance. Right. I mean, wherever there's a problem in the Middle East, we find that Qatar tries to put itself in the middle. Just one of the things we were talking about last week was that the Qataris are bringing in luggages full of cash. They literally had four large suitcases. Each one had $5 million in it. They crossed from Israel, went into Gaza, and just started distributing Qatari cash. I remember when their sums were only $250,000 being given out to center right American Jewish organizations. We had a big coverage on that a year or two ago. But now it seems as if though there's a situation where they're spreading their influence and their money around in order not necessarily just to stay relevant, but to try to stay in the news. And I think this is the way that they branch out and remain relevant to the United States, or try to remain relevant to the United States, especially considering the fact that only Turkey and Iran are still supporting Qatar's ability to exist as an autonomous state in the Persian Gulf. We have a Turkish military presence there. The Iranians give Qatari Airways the airspace to be able to actually fly out of the country. Otherwise, they would be jammed in. And now we have the Emir going to the United States. We have agreements, I think, that were signed between the Dominican Republic and Qatar. There was an outreach with Colombia. I mean, they're really trying to throw their wealth around, punching above their weight. And now the Iran negotiation channel is just another in a whole litany of items that they're trying to do to be pro-Western. But at the same time, and I know I talk about this ad nauseum, and we always bring this subject up, just the amount of nefarious behavior and the amount of ill will that they are exhibiting. On one hand, they're smiling to the United States. On the other, they're undermining the United States by sponsoring almost every single Middle East-based terror organization that's on the U.S. OFAC and FTO list, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, and the Foreign Terror Organizations list from State Department, or what's also called the SDT, the Specially Designated Terrorist List. They have funding to Hezbollah, to Al-Qaeda, to Jabhat al-Nusra, or now Hizbollah al-Tahrir. They have been known to have supplied ISIS. A big investigative report came out last Thursday from a new publication called the Investigative Journal. I encourage everyone to check that out. A former Turkish intelligence official basically fled the country. He was accused of being a Gulenist, a follower of the Hizmet movement, Fethullah Gulen, one of the main opposition groups to Turkey's Erdogan, besides the legitimate political opposition and the CHP, the Republican Party. And he revealed that Qatari money was coming in on C-130 planes. The Turks used that money to buy weaponry, and then Turkish trucks shipped it across the Syrian border from an area called Gaziantep, which is one of the main, or it was before the Turks built a wall and a perimeter fence along the Syrian-Turkish border. They go through Gaziantep, offload the weapons to ISIS. ISIS then loads black market oil from the Syrian northeast Syrian oil fields that they had been occupying before the Kurds took it back from them, put it back into Turkey, and they sell it at a much reduced price. You have a similar model that's actually going on right now if you want to talk about where Qatar's causing problems in Libya. This is actually news that I was just made aware of a few days ago, but I think that it's relevant because this is not a country that we often speak about. I mean, yeah, the United States was involved in the effort to help topple Muammar Gaddafi 7 years ago, Gary?
Yeah, 2011.
And then the country split into different factions. We heard about it again with the Benghazi attack on Ambassador Chris Stevens, where he was killed. His compound was overran by a Libyan militia. I think it was called Al-Fatah Al-Amma, but we can get the name on that, and Gary, you can correct me later on that. But then the country as it exists now has somewhat stabilized in Tripoli, which is where the Libyan capital is, and it's also where the UN-backed government, largely consisting of Islamists, sits, with Libya's financial and banking sectors being there. And then in the east of the country, in Benghazi, this infamous city Benghazi, it's actually being ruled by the anti-Islamists and a man named Khalid Haftar, who is backed by the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia. So you have the Islamists in Tripoli and the anti-Islamists that are in Benghazi. You also have an ISIS faction in a city called Sirte. You have Gaddafi's son, who actually was able to buy his freedom and hopes to run for president in the country. But the reason I bring up all these details, you know, this may be kind of an arcane discussion Gary, hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Sorry, I had a little buzz there. That this may be a little bit too getting into the weeds, too much in the minutia, is because the Islamists in Tripoli have signed and inked a deal with Turkey to provide them with Turkish drones being flown by Turkish, and they're using these drones to stop the advance on Tripoli from the anti-Islamist forces under Haftar and Benghazi. And they've actually gone so far as to not just take out some targets that are on the anti-Islamist side, but you have Emirati and Egyptian officers that were providing tactical coordination and let's call it advisory services, as in quotation marks, that were part of the anti-Islamist forces. So you have Turkish soldiers controlling drones. And by the way, the Turkish drones are being paid for by none other than Qatar. And they're taking on Emirati and Egyptian led Libyan anti-Islamist forces. So it's not just ISIS in Syria where we have this proxy battle going on. It's not just up here in the Golan Heights where we have another Iranian, Syrian, Russian, American proxy battle going on. It's now extended all the way to Libya. And I even, you know, Gary, we talked last week, 2 weeks ago about the Yemen conflict. There is a bunch of proxy wars going on, and I don't think that America is aware of who exactly is behind it, what their interests are. And if we don't spend more time discussing this and bringing this to light, I think that we might end up finding ourselves, like Donald Trump did yesterday in the White House, sitting with a smiling, mischievous leader while with one hand tied behind his back is actually orchestrating mayhem and destruction against American allies or American allies' proxies throughout the rest of the region. So that's just something that I thought I would bring to light. But, Gary, we had some interesting news briefs that came out over the last few days. And I want to just thank Michael Levinson, our resident Washington fellow, for putting this all together. But I thought that we would start with Iran and a rather unfortunate incident that happened to the U.S. terror-designated Iran Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. On Wednesday, the IRGC said in a statement that three members of their segment in an Iranian town called Piranshahr were killed when terrorists opened fire on their car, adding that an IRGC member had been wounded in the attack. The semi-official Mehr news agency said Kurdish militants had killed the IRGC members in an ambush in a village near the Iran-Iraq border. The area has been the scene of clashes between Iranian forces and Kurdish militants in the past. Gary, I want to go back to the interview that we did with one of our Iranian dissident friends a week or two ago. And he made this point that Iran is 50% Persian and 50% other minority groups. Do you think that we're going to see more minority on Persian type attacks like the Kurds attacking an IRGC unit in the next few weeks or months, considering the heightened tensions in the region?
I think it's possible. The sanctions are really working on Iran. Economic conditions are getting worse and worse. I think Iran's – the social fabric of Iran is going to be tested in a lot of ways. For years, though, people have been predicting ethno-sectarian trouble in Iran. You also have a large Arab Sunni minority along the coast.
Right, the Avazis.
And there's been speculation that, you know, if one was really going to take on Iran using the same methods that Iran has taken on the rest of the region, it would be to sponsor proxy forces in Iran. And you'd think there would be plenty of opportunity for groups, especially minority groups, to take action now.
Now, we have to note that there was also an attack on the Iranian parliament some two or three years ago where an ISIS cell actually went in and tried to attack. I think one was the former Ayatollah's grave site, and the second was an attack on the parliament house itself. I think that just as much as we expect the enemies of America to condemn attacks on innocent civilians here in the U.S. and in the West, that this kind of let's call it blue on green attack, or in this case, maybe it's a green Islamist on another green Islamist, is not something that should be a pursued strategy. I actually think that this is not the kind of conflict the U.S. should be trying to irking. But at the same time, if you have a Kurdish sectarian group or a rebel group that's going after a foreign terror organization, at least designated by the United States, it kind of seems like fair game.
Right. It's, you know, The fact is, in the Middle East, bad guys often fight bad guys as well.
Yeah. Moving to Lebanon, the U.S. Treasury has added three top Hezbollah figures to its list of sanctioned individuals, including two members of the Lebanese parliament, Amin Sherry and Mohammed Hassan Ra'ad, and Wafiq Safa, a security official responsible for coordinating between Hezbollah and Lebanon security agencies. It was the first time that the U.S. Treasury has designated a member of Lebanon's parliament under a sanctions list that targets those accused by Washington of providing material support to terrorist organizations. Now, this goes a long way, I think, at least to looking at what the U.S. is expecting from its allies. The European Union is the one that comes to mind. I mean, the United Kingdom has already designated Hezbollah's militant wing, its terror wing, as a terror entity. It recently just also applied that to its political wing. But you have Lebanese members of parliament who are associated with the Hezbollah political faction still able to basically travel freely throughout Europe. And maybe the U.S. now taking the step of not just focusing on Hezbollah's fundraising mechanism, its drug and illicit activity empire, smuggling, not to mention its militant and military activities and transnational violence that it's largely responsible for, whether it was the AMIA attack in Argentina, the bombing there, a lot of activity in Benin, the tri-border area in South America, not to mention the Marine barracks bombing and the ambassador bombing. We have to be able to find that by moving over to the political list that we find ourselves in a situation that this may be the U.S. saying, you know what? Every part of Hezbollah is off limits. You will not have any interactions. We will not allow European banks to give them bank accounts. We will not allow to have anyone meet with them. If you're going to deal with them in any financial way, you're going to be held accountable. Now moving on towards Saudi Arabia. French prosecutors said on Tuesday they were pushing for a six-month suspended prison sentence for the King of Saudi Arabia's daughter as she went to trial in absentia in a case involving the beating of a workman in her luxury flat in Paris. Princess Hassa bin Salman is being tried on charges of complicity to violence with a weapon and complicity to kidnap an Egyptian-born artisan who was carrying out repairs in her father's residence on the exclusive Avenue Foch in September 2016. Gary, this is an example of more misbehaving Saudis, not to the level of what we saw 9 months ago. But it's significant, I think, that a Western country is actually holding them to account.
It is. It typically this kind of thing is brushed under the rug, but it doesn't help when your brother is Mohammed bin Salman.
No, not at all.
Bonesaw bin Salman is not really the best.
Lastly, another instance which happened here in Israel before we go to a commercial break, Hamas launched a highly rare training exercise Tuesday night, deploying most of its forces, simulating the capture of an IDF special forces unit operating in the territory. Gazans reported a spike in the movement of armed personnel in the streets, including along the border with Israel, before the Hamas-run Interior Ministry in the territory announced it was a military drill. It included police, intelligence units, and the terror group's military wing, the Izzedine Al-Qassam Brigades. Hamas officials told Arabic language media that the exercise simulated an incursion by Israeli security forces. The exercise appears to be linked to an IDF special forces operation in the Gaza Strip that went awry after the undercover Israeli force was discovered, resulting in the death of a soldier in the ensuing gun battle. Let's hope that doesn't become reality, Gary. After these messages, Tommy Robinson from the UK.
The Israel Victory Project steers U.S. policy toward backing an Israel victory over the Palestinians to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. Decades of what insiders call peace processing have left matters worse than where they started. The time has come for a new approach, a complete rethinking of the problem that draws on Israel's earlier and successful strategy of deterrence. Stop pressuring Jerusalem to compromise and make painful concessions. Instead, support Israeli victory, convincing Palestinians and others that the Jewish state will endure. Read more at meforum.org.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all, the few, the proud, the Marines.
Welcome back to Middle East Forum Century Radio here on WWDB 860 AM, the home of Philadelphia's Intelligent Talk Conversation. And if you're listening on our podcast, you can catch the Middle East Forum podcast on SoundCloud. We have something over 40 episodes now, I think, Gary, that's available there. Mm-hmm. And the recordings, insofar as they cover the whole gamut of the Middle East and Islamism, are somewhat timeless. I mean, if you want to learn about Egypt, there's a great podcast that took place in November. If you want to get an understanding of the roots of Islamism in Paris and in France from 20 years ago, we have a great interview that took fellows in February. It really is an archive that gives you access to a whole, not just plethora of information, but a depth that I don't think you can find in any other audio recording on a 58-minute track anywhere, at least in our field in the United States. Perhaps it's an asset that might even be worth listening to for international audiences as well. Gary, I want to get your feedback before we bring our guest on. We're expecting Mr. Robinson to join us at 10:25. But you've been putting up a lot of articles in your role as the editor of the Middle East Forum website, Middle East Forum Online. And we're also joined by our director of communications this morning, Ms. Lisa Barbunas. And both of you have this conversation about monitoring what's going on in the world. We have this balance that we have to be able to achieve when it comes to delivering articles to our readership. A lot of things going on in foreign policy, a lot of things going on in the United States. From the last month or two of what you've been publishing, what have you noticed have been the trends in terms of how foreign policy issues that we're covering, for instance, the Manama Bahrain Palestinian-Israeli peace conference that Jared Kushner presided over a few weeks ago, versus the articles that we're producing on Islamist activities in the United States, campus professors commenting on this. Have you noticed more of an intersection? This is for both of you.
What do you mean an intersection?
So we have this article that comes out from Seth Franzman. I think he wrote five things you need to know about the Manama peace conference.
Right.
And then we have two or three days later, Winfield Myers, the director of Campus Watch, helping work on an article. I'm not sure if it's out yet. That was the campus professors in Middle East and Islamic studies at American universities reaction to Manama. And then a week after that, there's an article being put out, I think, by Warren Litwin, or there might have been a blog post by Sam Westrop, the director of Islamist Watch, where he's saying Islamists react to the Bahrain peace conference. It's as if, though, we've been able to create this sort of conveyor belt of content. And I think it's unique insofar as, you know, most think tanks either do foreign, they do domestic, but we've really got a good hybrid model here of synergy between covering domestic events and foreign events. Have you noticed any sort of linkage like that in the last few months that you might want our readers to be able to, or listeners to read or to point out?
Oh, sure. Our Islamist Watch project monitors lawful Islamist groups in the United States, which normally has mainly domestic implications. But one of the big controversies in the last month among Islamist groups is reaction to the death of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Islamist Watch director Sam Westrop just wrote a great article about a very ugly verbal dispute between an affiliate of MPAC, the Muslim Public Affairs Committee, and the speaker who was disinvited from an event because he planned to talk about the quote unquote injustice of former President Mohamed Morsi's death, which upsets a lot of Egyptians who aren't Islamists. So this became a big a big issue, and it was largely a foreign, it was largely goings on in the Middle East that sparked this.
And I think it's amazing that, you know, what happens, and Morsi was no small figure. I mean, you know, to give him a little bit of legitimacy, not to give him too much. He was the first and only democratically elected leader of Egypt. It was a 52-48 split between him and Ahmed Shafiq.
Right.
He had a lot of influence over Islamists, or a lot of hope for Islamists, and that hope came crashing down after millions of Egyptians demanded his departure less than a year into his term as president of that country. So, yeah, there's a lot to be spoken about in terms of how he is sort of the next Mossadegh, maybe. I mean, there was a comparison between him and the former Iranian prime minister that was taken out by a Western-backed or an American British engineered coup in the 50s. Actually, Kermit Roosevelt was involved with that. He's one of Roosevelt's sons.
There's nothing that can put the shine on a mediocre dictator like being overthrown by someone linked to the United States, because then you become a martyr, and it doesn't matter how well you governed. The only thing that matters was how well you weren't allowed to govern because you weren't there.
Yeah, just have the U.S. try to take you on. Right. Lisa, do we have Mr. Robinson on the line?
Not yet.
He's calling him right now.
Okay.
We'll be two more seconds.
So just to give a little bit of background on our next guest, and this has more to do with the institution that the Middle East Forum has, one of the projects, rather than just the individual who will be highlighting the injustice that took place last week in the United Kingdom. For the past 12 years, this was actually an outgrowth of a case that took place here in the United States. We have found an increasing amount of left-wing, of state-sponsored institutions, and even of Islamist groups using courts, both in the civil and the criminal arena, to try to suppress the public discussion of issues related to Islam. Now, it's not just all Islamism. If someone expresses something about a tenet of Islam, if they have a critique of the Quran, if they have something that they want to raise in terms of the specter of a certain grouping of individuals who may have disproportionately created more crimes and attributed that either to not their ethnicity being the route, but the unabridged and the unregulated activity and the characters that they have been able to put forward, this is where the Legal Project comes in. The Middle East Forum does not take a stance on the opinions articulated by the recipients of Legal Project aid, but we do stand adamantly behind them in their right, which we believe is a universal right to express themselves. This isn't just a First Amendment protection. This isn't just about freedom of press and freedom of speech. It's a tenet that most Western liberal democracies, in our view, should adopt, that more speech is the answer to trying to find issues that are problematic or emblematic of a society that is trying to suppress speech. And our next guest, Mr. Tommy Robinson, has been through a gamut over the last, I guess it's 13 months now, where he was tried, locked up, sentenced, and put in a solitary confinement, all in the span of 5 hours, in a kangaroo court that took place in May of last year. He was paraded through one of the most vicious jails in the United Kingdom, having only access to canned food because of the fear that he may have been poisoned, only to be released after massive street demonstrations and the British public demanding that he be released, and that being justified, at least on the initial term of his imprisonment, and the reason for putting him behind bars, was a great miscarriage of justice. Mr. Robinson was then released from jail. And for the last 10 months, I guess is the right period of time, has been trying to take his case to not just the British public, the European public, but also to the rest of the world. And we have found the institutions, both state-sponsored and private corporations, have been trying to find ways to cease his ability to access avenues of expression, whether it's YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, his own website, trying to go after the domain service, which is putting his news column online. And it came to a climax last week when only a few months ago the Attorney General of the United Kingdom decided it was in the public's interest to retry Mr. Robinson on contempt of court charges. The court found him guilty last week. Now, this wasn't a trial by jury. This was an administrative decision by a judge in the United Kingdom. And regardless of whether it's respect for the British system of justice, the general tenet that someone, and at least this is my personal opinion, I'm not articulating an institutional position here, but the general tenet that someone who was acting as a journalist, filming a event that was taking place, and he is now facing a jail sentence for trying to express and trying to inform the public, after there was newspaper articles in the BBC, in the Independent, in the Times of London, all categorizing the same story that he was reporting on from the Leeds County Courthouse, he's now facing what I think is retribution. And look, there's the spirit of the law, the letter of the law. It is a decision that I will talk to Mr. Robinson that I think should be respected. But the law itself has to be changed. And that's why he's now pursuing a amnesty claim for political asylum in the United States, probably the last country on earth that totally respects not absolute free speech. You can't yell fire in a movie theater, but I'd say absolute free political speech. Mr. Robinson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. And I'll just start off with a massive thank you to everyone. Thank you to everyone at the Middle East Forum who have continued to help me fight for my free speech and help me fight for justice and fight for my rights. So, I'm going to be sentenced tomorrow. You're right. It was by two appointed judges. When you talk about the law, you talk about if I had broke the law. The truth is I haven't broke the law. Now, and this is where it gets. This is where I'm shocked, completely shocked, and so are my legal team, that I have been found guilty of these charges. Because what I've actually been found guilty of is one charge of breaching the reporting restriction. Second charge is that I caused anxiety to the convicted child Muslim paedophiles by asking them the question how they feel about the verdict. I was calm. I was polite. They've said that caused them anxiety, which could have impeded in the course of justice because they might have felt worried about coming to court. Okay, they felt worried about coming to court because they knew they'd been raping children. Yeah, I don't know how they were on bail anyway, walking the streets. But anyway, they've all been convicted. That was one of the charges, and the other charge was photographing them and videoing them. Now, on the reporting restriction, there was a reporting restriction put on, and so that people can understand. In this country, in our country, 90% of the convictions for child gang rape, grooming, are Muslim men. Muslim men make up 2% of the population, but they're responsible for 90% of the convictions. Now, I've known, and I've got, for over a decade, I've been screaming about this issue. Now, 10 years ago, when I first started talking about it, no one would talk about it, no one knew about it. There was no mention of it. And slowly, we've got on the streets, and we've made our voice heard, and we've forced the government, we've forced the police, and forced the media to talk about this issue. What it then turns out with a government report is in one small town called Rotherham, there were 1,400 children victims. In that town, 20% of the Muslim men are under investigation for the rape of these kids. 20%. Okay? That's how big the problem is. Now, they don't want the public being aware of this problem because their utopia world that they're trying to create with open borders and mass immigration, these are the realities that come with some of the cultures that are imported. These are the problems that come with the intolerant view towards women, the intolerant view towards non-Muslims. So this is a massive epidemic across our country. And what we saw in over a 12-month period was literally 72 investigations in towns and cities that were identical. They're all Muslim gangs. They use taxis. They use pizza shops. They use their businesses as honeypots to trap the children in. They offer them free food. They give them drugs. They give them alcohol. And then they enslave them. Literally, they've been murdered. Multiple children have been murdered. And this was a conspiracy of silence for a decade in this country. Now, I was on the forefront, brought it to the forefront, and their whole process throughout all of this, and it hasn't changed, is to cover it up. So what we now see in our courts is rather than keep 12 members of the jury in the dark over issues, we keep 60 million members of the British public, unlike America. Yeah? What they now do is for every single one of these trials, they put a reporting restriction where nobody can even mention that there's a court case on. Now, that doesn't make any sense at all, even to the fairness of justice. Even if their reason was they don't want prejudice to the jury. How can you prejudice a jury by simply saying there's a trial on? Now, these reporting restrictions prohibit people from even mentioning there's a trial on. And that's why they can't trial any of the proceedings. Now, when I went to Leeds Crown Court that day, I went, and this is where the law comes in, and I'm pleading with... I pleaded with the with Donald Trump and his administration. I'm pleading with everybody, please look at the facts of this case. I am being convicted for the crime of journalism when I haven't actually broke their laws. On the judiciary website, anyone can do this. But on the judiciary's own website, if you Google reporting restrictions criminal courts, it will come up as a top link. If you click on there, there's a 40-page document. It is a... advisory, is the guidelines for journalists and media for reporting restrictions in British courts, okay, in criminal courts. It's a 40-page document. On page 27, you will read, and I pay privately, so people understand my background. I am a citizen journalist. I wasn't educated. I didn't go to university and study journalism. I'm a citizen journalist, and I've become the most watched journalist in the UK very quickly. I had 59 million people watch my videos in a four-week period. 172 million people read my tweets. That's in 1 4-week period. So I've become very strong as a journalist, and I was the most watched, and I've become the most famous journalist in the UK. Now, then they're not in control of the narrative anymore, or on the stories that are going out. And I'm going straight to the truth, straight to the facts. Here's what's happened. Here's how it's happened. Now, I paid privately to go to a law firm called Kingsley Napoli, who won the leading law firm in London. And I had my training on contempt of court, on reporting restrictions. And this has all come out as evidence in my case, that I went to this organisation, I paid myself, and I had training. Now, in this training, I went through this contempt of court guidelines, which is on the judiciary's own website. And now on there, it says, on page 27, a judge has no power under section 4.2 of the reporting restriction to put a reporting restriction on any information that's already in the public domain. So he can't do it. So I've read that. I've gone up to Leeds Crown Court. I've seen these gangs walking in and out of court. I know many of the details of the case. I know the verdicts from the first part of the case. And I've gone into court and I've asked if there's a reporting restriction. Yeah? And I was told they don't know. Then on the website, and these are the guidelines that they have to follow. If there's a reporting restriction, it has to be on the court website. It has to be on the court door. And it has to be on the court screen. Now, they've accepted in this trial that none of those guidelines are followed. Through error. It was nowhere. But that doesn't matter anyway. It's irrelevant whether those signs were there or not, because I didn't breach the reporting restriction. What I then did, to be honest, even though I couldn't find any evidence of the reporting restriction, I wanted to err on the side of caution. So I literally stood outside and I read a BBC News article. Now, according to the law on the judiciary's own website, they don't have any power to put a reporting restriction on information that's already in the public domain. And this is where this is so comical. It would be comical if I wasn't about to get killed in his next prison sentence. But what they said in court is, no, that's not right. What it says on the website, that's not right, that's not the law. Even though, if you go on this and look at this judiciary's website, it has a full word from the Lord Chief Justice himself, where he thanks the legal chamber for the legal accuracy of the document. Now, I stuck to the law on that document to the word. I didn't break it.
So, Mr. Robinson, I don't want to cut you off here. I know you have to give us a background of everything that took place. But if we can just get to the end of the decision that the judges made last week, what is it that they found you guilty of?
They said that I breached the reporting restriction by reading publicly held information, because they said, no, that's not the law, even though it's on their website. They said that by asking the defendants how they feel about their verdict, that I could have caused them anxiety. They found me guilty of contempt of court and I could have impeded the course of justice by
so this by is that. This is a procedural issue. This is not a what I would say is a criminal. You weren't attempting to at least from your words, I understand, you weren't attempting to breach anything. You took caution. You erred on the side of caution. Now, you won an appeal a year ago. Yes. Do you have plans to take this to appeal?
I have to take this to appeal because I will be killed in jail. And the reason why is the injustice of this. I haven't broken any law. Do you know this is a civil offence? This is a civil crime, and it's the only crime. So basically what the Attorney General has done is through the back door, they've got me in a courtroom where they can sentence me to 2 years prison without a jury. And like Magna Carta, English common law says, if you can face 6 months in prison, you have the right to a jury to be tried by 12 members of your peers. The reason for that is fair justice. I have not been tried by 12 members of my peers. I have not been tried by a jury. I've been tried by two judges who, again, if you watch the video, the entirety of the video, and then read their judgment, there are two complete lying judgments. And the reason that they can get away with this is that the corporate globalist media will push that lie across the world. They'll lie to everyone. And now that I'm completely censored and removed from all of social media, I used to have the biggest reach of any Facebook page in Britain. Yeah? I'm deleted from all of them. Snapchat, YouTube, Facebook, they're deleting me from all of them. So my reach to tell people, actually, look at this, here's the fact, has gone. They now completely control the narrative. And on that narrative was pushed out. They're lying, saying that I nearly jeopardised the trial. It's been proven in two courts that nothing I said could have prejudiced the jury. So that is not that I've not been convicted of nearly collapsing the trial. I've not been convicted of prejudicing the jury. I've been convicted of causing anxiety to child rapists by asking them a simple question. Freedom of the press. We live in a post-free speech era in the UK anyway. There is no free speech. And I know and I know your organisation fights for it. And exactly what you said was true, because even when I've met Daniel Pipes, we disagreed on many things over Islam, over my stance on Islam, his stance on Islam, and his stance on Islamism. But the fight for freedom of speech, this shouldn't come into politics on who thinks what and who agrees with who. This is a fundamental right. And right now, the left are celebrating the fact that our free speech and our rights are disappearing in this nation. There's the media are celebrating, journalists are actually celebrating that I'm about to be in prison for journalism.
Mr. Robinson, to clarify, are you arguing that the reporting restrictions that are routinely imposed on trials for these Muslim grooming gangs, that's creating a lack of public knowledge or a lack of public awareness about the threat, and so you were attempting to correct that?
The Law Commission. So the Law Commission in 2014 done an in-depth investigation for the Attorney General. And it was a look at contempt of court and reporting restrictions. Now, they come back with one sole recommendation. And that recommendation was that you create one website nationwide, one website, so that journalists and members of the public, if there's a court case, they can go on the website and they can see which court cases have reporting restrictions. Now, this was their sole recommendation after a six-month report that they spent that hundreds of thousands of pounds doing this report on to look at it. They said it's unfair. Now, the reason why they haven't done that is because if they did do that, you'd go on that website right now, and you'd see how many secret trials there are going on in the UK of Muslim men who are on trial for the gang rape, prostitution, kidnap of our daughters. And that's not what they want, because the whole reason for this is to hide it. So I am telling you that public awareness on these issues would prevent these issues. It would protect children. If the whole British public knew the scale of this problem, how they operate, where they operate, how many of them are operating, it would give the parents and families a chance to stop it and prevent it. And I speak from a family who... I want to start talking about this issue because it happened to a relative of mine. The gang rape, prostitution and kidnap. And when the families went to the police, this is decades ago, when our families went to the police did nothing. And this has all now been proven. And what I'm saying is that these reporting restrictions, even though the judge put a reporting restriction in place, according to the law on their own website, which has been there for 6 years, which has the foreword of the Lord Chief Justice, everything I said that day was in the public domain. Now, it makes no sense at all why a reporting restriction would prohibit anyone even letting you know there's a court case on, unless you're trying to hide it. I understand reporting restrictions for, and actually I say in my live stream video, when these verdicts are given, I won't be able to let you know the verdicts because there's a restriction. And it makes sense for there to be a restriction on the verdicts if there's three separate trials. It doesn't make sense for there to be a restriction on any of the other information in that case. The names of the people, especially when you read that they don't have the power to put a reporting restriction on public information. You can go on the court website and read the names. It's public information. I read from a newspaper. What I'm saying is, and I know this may sound in America, but I tried to explain it, that if the Democrats had power in your country, you would see all, and basically we have been governed and ruled by the equivalent of, and the erosion of our free speech, the erosion of the ability to be even critical of ideas, the erosion and the attack on all of that as they could completely gain control and power, and they erode free speech, and they scare the public and intimidate them into silence. That's what's happened in my country for decades. Everyone is so scared to speak. And that's because they come down, and I've been using an example of, look what we will do to you. look what we can do. Whilst I do...
Lisa, just before we get to this, I just want to touch on the issue of grooming gangs for a second. And Tommy, I want to read something to you that was by Home Secretary Sajid Javid, which came out in October of last year. It was a tweet that he put out where he says, referring to grooming gangs, an article that was in the BBC, 20 members of grooming gang convicted. And he says, these sick Asian pedophiles are finally facing justice. I want to commend the bravery of the victims. For too long, they were ignored. Not on my watch. There will be no no-go areas. And then he continues after he's criticized for using the term Asian and saying sick Asian pedophiles, and asked by the British Pakistani novelist Camilla Shamsi, who was guest editing the program. His response was that it's very important and we very much need to be aware for the need of politicians to be careful with their language. But when it comes to gang-based child exploitation, it is evident, self-evident to anyone who cares to look, that if you look at all the recent high-profile cases, there is a high proportion of men that have Pakistani heritage. What do you think?
Well, my original charge is that you helped me get free. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
Sorry, you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we had a technical
issue. This was one of my challenges. Yeah, something happened there. This was one of my charges. This was originally one of my charges, was because I'd get statistics, which they then say those statistics are hate. Now, on the issue of this grooming, I've grown up in Luton Town. Luton Town has 35 mosques, okay? We have a large Pakistani community. Some of the lads I grew up with, the best lads I met in my life, are from that community. They're Muslim, okay? They would be horrified and disgusted at what these men have done, okay? So I'm not in any way, and I made this point in my lead video outside the court case. I'm not saying this is all Muslims. I'm not saying this is all Pakistanis. What I'm saying is, if we want to protect our daughters, if we want to solve this problem, we have to understand it. Now, to understand it, we're going to have to ask challenging questions and look at the reality and the complex issues of why this is so prevalent in this community. Why do these men, why are brothers, cousins, work colleagues thinking it's acceptable for the first time in British history? Usually paedophiles share their sick fantasies with other paedophiles they meet online. This is, for the first time, brothers, cousins, and work colleagues are sharing 11-year-old children together and raping them in rooms together. And there is no one reporting it, no one angry, no one snitching. It's completely new to our country. And it's prevalent and it's happening in every single town and city. And it's that they want to cover up. And the reason why they want to cover that up is because they've employed this. And we're supposed to celebrate it. But we have to talk about it. So, yeah. And I feel that I faced, for 10 years, the reason why I made the appeal to Donald Trump is, if Donald Trump was in the UK, he'd be arrested and he'd be tried for exercising his First Amendment. Trust me. Sadiq Khan would make sure that. The political pressure and the hatred for him is similar to the political pressure and the hatred for me. Because I'm the only citizen journalist and the most known citizen journalist and the only person that's willing to stand on the TV and anywhere I go and say, no, actually, that's not right. No, actually, this is the reality. Actually, here's the truth. You may want to hide the truth, but it's still the truth. And the truth can never be hate speech. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing in this country. So, yeah, I face prison tomorrow. I've got 3 young children. I had to sit last night and explain to my son, and this is a difficult conversation I'm having to have, because I don't think I'm going to come out of that jail. And my son's telling me that, my son's saying, why can't you just say sorry, Daddy? Why can't you just stop? I said, because I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry for exposing and highlighting, even if it saves one girl. And I explained this to him like last time. I have a 12-year-old daughter. And when I explained last time, I said, look at your sister. Some girls your sister's age are being taken. They're being kidnapped. They're being hurt and tortured in rooms. If me speaking the truth, which I'm going to do to tomorrow outside that courtroom, and I'm going to do in court if they let me, I'm going to continue to speak the truth. If me speaking the truth raises awareness, it saves one girl, then I'll take whatever fate I face tomorrow. And I'll take whatever fate I face tomorrow. But the reality is, it has to save one girl. That video outside Leeds Crown Court with the statistics and the facts of what's happening to our daughters in this country went around the world. Essentially, whilst I don't want to make a challenge to the judge, the best thing that can happen to highlight the rape and prostitution of young girls in this country and the torture that they face at the hands of these migrant gangs, the best thing that could happen would be for that judge to send me to prison tomorrow. Now, that's not the best thing that happened for me, because I'm terrified. But my course to awaken the British public, to awaken them to the problems that we face living at the bottom, because remember, most of these people who are judging us and ruling over us and the heads of the police and the politicians don't live where we live. They import this mindset in, they import this culture in, it affects us. It affects our doors. So if anyone stands on the side of freedom, all I'd ask is that when I'm in prison tomorrow, to continue flying my name and shouting my name and screaming my name so that people don't forget my name, because I genuinely believe I'll be killed.
Tommy.
And I'll be killed for journalism.
Speaking of prison, how long do you anticipate being sentenced tomorrow? You think, the maximum is up to 2 years, correct? Is the maximum?
The maximum is up to 2 years. My solicitor expects I'll get 18 months.
18 months.
My solicitor expects I'll get 18 months. But I was given an option. I was given an option last year to apologise and I can go home. To apologise and I can go home. Apologise for what? Apologise for reading public information outside the courtroom? Because if you watch my behaviour that they're lying to the public about, if you just watch my video, I was not aggressive. I was polite. I was calm. Even in the face of aggression against me, even in the face of the most vulgar sexual remarks against my family, I was still very calm and polite. Apologise for journalism. Apologise for free speech.
There is one rule for you and another rule for everybody else there. Even if you were actually guilty of these contempt of court charges, it's a disproportionate sentence as compared to other people's that were convicted of the same exact crime.
No journalist, Lisa. No journalist in 60 years has ever been sent to prison for this offence. Journalists have clapped trials. The Stephen Lawrence murder trial, that was a racist murder trial. The journalist prejudicial reporting claps the trial. He got a £3,000 fine. Another murder trial. A trial collapsed and one girl never got justice for what happened to her. £10,000 fine. One woman committed 26 contempt of courts before she was even brought to justice. There are another trial. I've gone through all the trials. Never has anyone been sent to prison. I've already spent for the publication of materials reporting. I've already spent 3 months on solitary confinement. Already. And yet they're going to do it again. And not just they're going to do it again, but I'm so shocked that the world can watch this. And all of the facts can be found. You just have to go on the website. You can watch the video of my thing and then read their judgment. You can see their lies yourself. You can read and study the laws, which is why I've made my appeal to any of the members of the American administration. Please look at my case. Please look at the laws. I haven't broke them. They're twisting and maneuvering and changing but as they go along in order to put me in prison, in order to slam me tomorrow. And, I'm grateful. And the only thing is that when I was in prison last time, I read in a paper, and I read the Middle East Forum, and I was sitting there, and I was surrounded by people who wanted to kill me. I knew I'd done nothing wrong. I knew they hadn't followed process. I knew I hadn't had a fair trial. I knew all of this. And I'm sitting there as my media and my politicians and human rights lawyers celebrate it. And they're trying to justify to the British public why I'm in jail. Because they hate freedom that much. And then I remember reading a quote from Daniel Quayle that said, "We will fight until this man is free." And the smile it put on my face knowing that people are fighting. So, I'm grateful.
It sounds to me like there's an element above and beyond whether there should be reporting restrictions, there's an enormous selective application. You know, Greg just read that statement from a conservative minister, which sounded to me like it violated the reporting restrictions as much as anything you did. He identified the ethnic background of the defendants. I mean, this, why wasn't he hauled in the court?
The actual reporting restrictions are, the actual wording on reporting restriction, it gives the case number. So on the reporting restrictions, it says there must be no reporting on these proceedings. Now, I didn't report on those proceedings. I knew all the details of those proceedings. I knew the verdicts. I knew the crimes. I knew the allegations. I knew it all. I went up there and simply stuck to the letter of the law on their website, and I reported information that was already in the public domain. I reported the names of the men, the allegations of the crimes they've committed. And whilst I'd done that, I was put in jail. One of the men was allowed to go home. He's evaded justice. He's in Pakistan. I'm going to be sent to prison for the second time for asking him how he feels about his verdict. He hasn't even been sent to prison. And he raped and prostituted young children for a decade. That's where we're at. That's where we're at in the UK. It's just, I just can't believe all this can happen whilst everyone can remain silent on it. And I have a fight, and I'm looking at an appeal now. I spoke to lawyers this morning, so I have to appeal it. I will appeal it, and I just hope that, like last time, the thing is with social media and censorship, you're not even allowed to mention Tommy Robinson now. If you mention my name, it'll be removed from Facebook. So the, the movement that grew last time, that saved me, that freed me, I don't think it can grow like that again. And they know that. And that's part of what this is. And that should terrify everybody. It should terrify everybody in America, because people celebrate now. I've seen your leading politicians talking about arresting people for making fun and arresting people for their comments and words. And that's you, that may seem a million miles away from you, but it's not, because that's already implemented here every day.
Well, Mr. Robinson, if I can just make a recommendation for when you're facing the judges tomorrow, yeah. and you've respected UK law and the system in which you are fighting and fighting against, but you'll stand there with your head high and you'll say, I did what I think was right for protecting those who I care about, for reporting on things that may not have been fair in this system. You even participated in the English political process when you ran for the European Union. You are not trying to violate any laws on purpose. It's the interpretation of a procedural notion of the feelings of an individual who was, if correct me if I'm wrong, convicted of a crime. And you are going for there, your head will stand high, you will say, I respect your decision, Your Honor, but everything that I have done has been to inform the public, and I hope that you'll respect the reason why I put it forward. Because that's really what this is at now. It's the interpretation of the law.
I've never had the intention.
Sure.
It's very strange, because in this country there's no right to privacy for defendants entering a courtroom. That's when everybody jumps on them. We're encouraged.
They jump on Tommy as he's walking into court too. So he's being charged for causing defendants anxiety when the press that surrounds him could actually cause more anxiety than what he did to these defendants.
So I want to give Tommy one more minute left. We've got 2 more minutes before we have to get off air. But Mr. Robinson, closing thoughts for our listeners.
I showed an identical video to the judge of me entering into the Old Bailey court, where I was surrounded by dozens of media, and I was asked the identical questions that I asked. And I said, I'm not saying that Lucy Manning, the BBC reporter that asked me those questions, was committing a crime. I'm saying that's robust British journalism, and that should be free to be done. What the laws are being used against me, they're being manipulated against me, and I'm about to be convicted because of who I am, not what I've done. And the person I am is a man who loves my country. I love our children, and I want what's best for them and the protection of them. And the British state has failed them. As I walk into the Old Bailey tomorrow, carved in stone, it says we will defend the children of the poor and punish the wrongdoer. Well, that's not what's going to happen tomorrow. And that's not what they've been doing. They certainly have not defended our children. And they're going to punish the people. They're going to punish me for trying to highlight and protect. So, again, I just say thank you, and I know that once I'm sitting in prison, that people will be silencing me on the outside, which gives me confidence to know my family are okay, and hopefully I'll walk back out and see them. So, yeah, and America, protect your freedoms. Don't let them erode in the way that ours has. Free speech is everything. Society has to be built on it.
Tommy Robinson, Godspeed tomorrow, and our mutual aim for, even though opinions may differ, the right to express those opinions should remain absolute. This is Greg Roman, Gary Gamble, and Lisa Barbunas on Middle East Forum Century Radio, and our production assistant, Delaney Janchek, for putting together this episode, and our special guest, Tommy Robinson. You can follow all the news and developments on meforum.org. Have a great week, Philadelphia. We'll be with you next Wednesday at 10 a.m.